The internet has changed how we find information, how we interact with our friends, how we get our news, and for many, it has also changed the act of worship. This hour, religion in the digital age. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We'll start the hour with an exploration of religion and social media. I'll talk with Elizabeth Drescher, author of Tweet If You Heart Jesus, Practicing Church in the Digital Reformation. And later in the hour, we'll take a larger look at how organized religion is changing in the 21st century. I'll talk with author, editor, and lecturer Phyllis Tickle, a leading voice in the emerging church movement. We also want to hear from you. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're going to talk about the evolution of religion in the 21st century. Later in the hour, I'll talk with author, editor, and lecturer Phyllis Tickle. She's a leading voice in the emerging church movement. But we're going to start the hour by focusing on how social media and other digital platforms have changed how many people worship. In a few minutes, I'll talk with L. Edward Phillips. He's a professor of worship and liturgical theology at Emory University in Atlanta. But my first guest is Elizabeth Drescher. She's a religious studies scholar at Santa Clara University in California and author of a number of books, including Tweet If You Heart Jesus, Practicing Church in the Digital Reformation. Hello, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're quite welcome.
And as we go through the hour, we also want to hear from you. Is social media an important part of your spirituality? Let us know how you use social media in your worship practices. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Of course, you can post on Facebook. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Elizabeth, one of the things that when we were researching this topic, we came across was an article that you wrote in 2011 about some of the big new trends in worship online. Of course, here we are a couple of years later, and really that has only grown. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of some of the social media trends that you see that are reshaping religion?
Well, you know, it does seem like 2011 was light years away, doesn't it? It's really kind of amazing. So there are, you know, in that particular piece, you know, one of the things that I talked about was prayer becoming a more social activity outside of institutional worship sites, outside of churches and synagogues and temples and like that. And at the time, there were a number of pages on Facebook where people were gathering for prayer and they were growing exponentially, and that's still happening. But really the new way that prayer is developing in social media is something that I hinted at in that article but hadn't really developed to the extent that it is now, and that is the hashtag prayer meme on Twitter. That we've really seen quite regularly in for example, the Boston Marathon bombings, a big splash of people using the pound sign hashtag symbol on Twitter and posting pray for Boston. So it's happening now that national and international tragedies or crises are coming into social media in religious ways through hashtags, but also personal prayers play out now on Twitter quite regularly. If you go into the Twitter search bar and search for the hashtag prayer or search for the hashtag lost job, unemployed, depression, all kinds of things, you'll see people praying all over Twitter. And I think the immediacy of that is part of its attraction and the way in which it allows people to express something important in their lives and engage with other people who are paying attention at that particular moment, but it's fleeting. So that's really changing in some important ways what prayer means in the culture and kind of unmooring it from very specific religious, identifiably religious contexts so that it comes to be for both people who are affiliated with religious institutions and those who are not, something that stands for, you know, an expression of hope and anxiety that there's really not another word for, and an invitation into something more relational than private, solitary prayer that we often think of, or communal worship-based prayer. So that's one thing I'm seeing.
Right. I've heard people describe that almost as a digital wailing wall, that there's something about the act of putting your prayer into words that seems to be an important experience for a lot of people, whether that is physically writing it down and sticking it in a wall or putting it on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah. Well, you know, there actually is a digital wailing wall. you can go online and put a prayer request out, and yeshiva students in Jerusalem will run out your request to the wailing wall and put it in there in paper. So that can happen too. But yes, in digital spaces like Twitter or Facebook, there is something about that public expression of prayer, regardless of how people respond. But there is also a lot of engagement around that. I've witnessed on any number of cases somebody tweeting some kind of prayer request and a whole bunch of people gathering in digital space around that person. So it's really relational too. It's not just a kind of individualistic, maybe narcissistic, sharing of what's in my soul and I don't really care to engage people. There are relationships that are forming out of that, both in digital spaces and that extend beyond digital spaces. You know, I saw something some time ago where a woman was going through a crisis and was looking, posted something about prayer, but was also looking for a community and was invited to attend a service at a cathedral in Seattle with some people who met her at a coffee shop. So I think that's the other important thing, that there's not anymore a really hard boundary between what's happening in digital spaces and what's happening in local spaces, because a lot of this is happening on mobile devices like smartphones and iPads and other tablets and things like that. So we all carry our technology into every part of our lives. So it's no longer someone, in his jammies in the basement at 3 a.m. It's somebody sitting at a Starbucks waiting for the bus, working through a long, boring meeting or something like that, and being connected in that way. So we're seeing that really shift quite a lot, so that now a lot of churches that used to say, if you have a smartphone with you, please turn it off right now at the beginning of worship, they're actually now often saying, please turn your smartphone on and tweet to people outside of the service, what you're hearing, what you're learning, what you're experiencing.
Interesting. Well, and let's talk about churches, because primarily we've been talking about individuals, and that can be individuals within a community, but clearly people are crossing different lines as far as it doesn't matter what kind of church you go to if you're praying on Twitter, for example. But what kind of actions and interactions are you seeing from actual churches online?
Well, you know, when I first started studying this and really looking at how new media was reshaping religion in, way back in 2007, when I talked to churches and other religious organizations, they, on the one hand, some people thought, oh, wow, this is a way for us to do advertising much cheaper. We can broadcast in ways we never could afford to do. And there were others who just felt like it was a stupid trend that was going to die out. They'd seen MySpace, it came, it went, and they weren't going to start a garage band anytime soon. So that's really changed. Now, having my colleague, Keith Anderson, talks about Facebook really being your digital narthex, really being the lobby, the front foyer of your church. People come to find out about churches and other religious groups by looking them up on Facebook or trying to find them on Twitter, or increasingly finding them in image-based sites like Pinterest or Instagram, so that they can get a sense of the community and begin interacting with people before they go there. So that's really changing how religious institutions are thinking about media. They're just beginning to move out of this idea that every time I'm saying something in a public space, I need to be preaching, moving away from that broadcast kind of mode into more relational modes. How do I listen to what people are saying and really attend to what's interesting to them and what's engaging, what their concerns are, and connect with them on the basis of their needs? So we're really seeing media creating more relationships that religious leaders and people in ministry are hoping will translate into some kind of local engagement. And certainly we see that, for example, you know, the big splash when Pope Benedict came on to Twitter a couple of years ago. You know, it got a lot of attention, but he was not a pope who really knew how to use media to craft relationships. So it was real broadcasty, kind of Bible-based slogans coming out on a regular basis. Pope Francis, on the other hand, is in active engagement with people. He tweets something on Twitter, and he'll actually respond to people. So there's more conversation happening in that way. And, you know, we're all in the midst of this, so we have no idea really how it's going to impact the actual structuring of religious communities in local spaces. My sense is that, you know, there will be more micro than mass-based relationships, and people will be, as you noted, exploring different ways of being religious in both digital and local spaces.
Well, and in just a moment, we're going to talk about some more official ways that different churches have tried to be online, creating their own social communities, for example. It sounds like, from your perspective, the most successful have worked within the structure that is already there. Would you say that, Elizabeth?
Within the structure of the...
Of Facebook and Twitter, the social networks that are already up and running.
Yeah, that's where people are. Facebook, people talk about from time to time about it dying down and it becoming a place for, grannies who are, essentially doing digital scrapbooking. But the fact is that almost every American with a computer of any age, any gender, any ethnicity is on Facebook. They might be, active in different ways at different times.
But they have been there. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back in just a moment. I'm talking with Elizabeth Drescher. She's a religious studies scholar at Santa Clara University in California. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the evolution of religion in the 21st century. We're going to take a bigger picture look in just a few minutes. I'll talk with author, editor, and lecturer Phyllis Tickle, who is a leading voice in the emerging church movement. Right now, though, we're focusing on digital worship. We're focusing on religion and social media. With me is Elizabeth Drescher. She's a religious studies scholar at Santa Clara University in California. She's also the author of a number of books, including Tweet If You Heart Jesus, Practicing Church in the Digital Reformation. And joining us now is L. Edward Phillips. He's a professor of worship and liturgical theology at Emory University in Atlanta. Hello, Ed.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. You are also a United Methodist minister, and you have a very interesting story about the use of digital media in worship, and I'd love to talk a little bit about it. I know that a Methodist congregation formally asked a bishop to start an online congregation. Was that about a year ago?
It was about a year ago. A church in North Carolina requested to have a pastor appointed to a virtual congregation that would be a second campus of their church or congregation in North Carolina. And this sort of started some official wheels turning to think about the ramifications of this for our practice in the United Methodist Church worldwide.
And tell me what happened. I mean, that sounds like a very innovative idea.
Well, this is the first congregation that has actually asked for official approval from a bishop to start this sort of ministry. And so various organizations in our denomination worldwide began to think about the ramifications for this, how it relates to our historic theology of practice, particularly online communion is would be a fairly major shift in how we've done things, but also about our ecumenical relations with our partners in the rest of the Christian world. I mean, we didn't want to, if you will, cross that bridge without conversing with others who are, you know, living in the same world we're living in, and just we wanted to stay part of that conversation.
So how did things work out? I know that eventually you convened a council of bishops and facilitated a discussion about how this was working and whether it was an appropriate part of the church.
Not exactly. What I did was convene a group of United Methodist theologians, lay leaders, clergy leaders to make a recommendation to our council of bishops. Something actually they had not requested particularly, but as Elizabeth has already said, things are moving at a just breakneck speed in the digital world, and we didn't think that we could wait until, say, our next general conference in 2016 to actually begin to think about this. And what we recommended was actually a more careful and detailed study of the question. Let's put a temporary halt on experiments until we can think about this a little bit more carefully. And indeed, this is what the bishops of the United Methodist Church have called for, is a further study of this. Another study group was formed. I mean, we form study groups in the United Methodist Church to look at problems.
And Ed, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We're having a terrible problem with your phone line, which I'm guessing has something to do with the weather.
Our weather here has been terrible, yes, here in Atlanta.
So I'm sorry that we're having a little bit of a hard time understanding you. So as a group, we'll try one more question, and we may have to let you go. But as a group, you decided that now was not the time for this. In general, what does the Methodist Church feel about the kind of religious interactions that are taking place online anyway?
Well, what we focused on specifically was the practice of communion online and not on the use of social media. I think, and that probably this is the opinion of many in the United Methodist Church that are leaders, that resisting the social media would be like resisting gravity. I mean, it's part of our world today. We have to not just contend with it. We use it. It's in the air we breathe. It's part of social life today. We can't completely disengage from it anymore. It's impossible.
Right. Well, and so Ed, I am going to have to let you go. But thank you so much for being willing to talk to us. And stay warm and stay safe. Stay off the roads if you possibly can. Thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you.
L. Edward Phillips is a professor of worship and liturgical theology at Emory University in Atlanta, also a Methodist minister, and unfortunately experiencing a serious snowstorm in Atlanta that's affecting the phone lines today. Elizabeth Drescher is still with us. I do want to get to the phones. Craig is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, there's so much on the internet going on about religion, people seeking after God, and so much about Christianity, God seeking after people. There are so many Christian blogs. You can study in the original languages, Hebrew and the Greek, where they'll even pronounce the words audibly on the computer. And it's really becoming obvious that religion is about doing. Christianity is about the God of the Bible, the Creator mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, and it's more about grace and about it's done. It was done on the cross.
So,
tremendous
so Craig,
resource.
Right. So, Craig, you feel that this digital world, not just social communities, but all of the access that you have to different information has really enhanced your worship?
Oh, it's just unbelievable. The resources that are on the internet just it's just overwhelming. And you really have to allow the Holy Spirit to lead you into all truth, because the truth will set you free. So there is, that's the only metric that, you know, people really need.
All right, Craig, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. Elizabeth?
Yeah, if I could just jump in, that's part of why the subtitle of Tweet of Your Heart Jesus is Practicing Church in the Digital Reformation. There's certainly this new access and new authority that people have to learn about their faith and to learn about other faith traditions as well. You know, it's really changing how people understand what religion is, not just Christianity, but other religions. You know, there are all kinds of websites, for example, and iPad and iPhone apps that help Muslims to practice prayer. And there are big discussions within Islam about, you know, when that technology is appropriate to use. Likewise, in Judaism, there are questions about how you practice Sabbath appropriately in a digitally integrated world, right? Because there's no more this distinction between what's virtual and what's real. It's all real. It's digitally integrated. So that's really reforming, you know, changing in profound ways, not just Christianity, but all religions at different paces and at different ways. You know, there are Buddhist meditation groups online that merge into everyday life with people, and apps where you can do contemplation with a particular Dharma teacher in Buddhism. So again, across all religious traditions, we're really seeing this media give all kinds of people access to the spiritual teachings of their tradition and other traditions, giving them authority to share that in other kinds of ways, and doing that, most importantly, in the context of their everyday life. So I don't have to wait until Saturday to go to synagogue to be praying with a group of people. I can do that on Tuesday,
right.
You know, through my iPhone.
Well, and I wish that Ed had been able to stay with us. There are churches that have obviously really embraced this and engaged with their community online. There are churches that have not embraced this. Do you see fear among some churches because of this incredible amount of access and crossover?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are kind of two levels of fear. There are, first of all, some communities that have what I would call ideological fear. They're afraid that new ideas are going to come into the church, and they are going to, and they're going to change the way people think about, you know, what is considered to be approved doctrine in the church, and especially they're going to undermine institutional authority. And all of those things are really going to happen. So churches that are happening, are more rigid on those spectrums, are really going to struggle with this shift, in the same way that churches that, you know, were not particularly interested after the Reformation and people reading the Bible on their own and interpreting it in their own language, had anxiety. So those things are happening. And it's kind of, as Ed said, it's like ignoring gravity to ignore the reality of this new media landscape.
I think there is also a concern, and I know that in the Methodist Church, this was part of the decision that they made, a concern that the human personal interaction of communion is missing from this digital world, and that a church may be undercutting their mission by taking too many things online.
You know what? I would have to say with all respect to the deliberation within a particular denomination, I think there's a misunderstanding about what happens in digital spaces as being disconnected from the quote unquote real world. Again, people are using technology in the context of their everyday lives. There are lots of more formal religious gatherings online, but lots and lots of informal ones as well. So I think it's actually kind of naive to think that what happens when I'm interacting with someone who's praying on Twitter is less real than what happens when I'm, you know, not seeing someone until Sunday and can only be engaged with that person once a week if we both happen to go to the same service and see each other at the same time. But neither one of them is more or less social, more or less providing an opportunity for communion. And more importantly, they're integrated. I have my iPhone with me when I go to church, and I have church with me on my iPhone. So I think that the churches that, and there are lots of online churches, I don't think many of them are really thriving, and they're not thriving in particular. They might have lots and lots of followers. They're not thriving in particular because they don't have that digitally integrated aspect where the local and the digital are bridged through the media. And that's the big thing that we're seeing now in new media and religion is not what's happening online and how do you bring it into your local space, or what's happening in your local space and how do you bring it online, but how do you use them really as media, as something that mediates between the two spaces? How do you make things digitally integrated? And that's the real challenge for churches now.
I want to go back. Ed did just rejoin us. He wants to weigh in on that quickly, Ed.
Well, on the online communion issue, one of the interesting points about the way this gets discussed is for the practice of Holy Communion gets reduced usually to somebody's experience, their thinking about it, how they feel about it. And what I want to ask, the question I would like to ask is, what gets lost in any sort of a digital virtual environment? What can't be done online? One thing that I think most people would agree that cannot be done online, for example, would be a meal ministry, a ministry to persons, say, that were homeless. That has to be done in real time with someone giving actual food to someone else.
And yeah, now, Ed,
I would,
if I could jump in, I'd ask about that. First of all, people who are experiencing homelessness are among the most digitally connected in the country because inexpensive mobile technology allows them to connect in lots of ways. So there are lots of ministries that, in fact, do provide meals and clothing and other kinds of service to people experiencing homelessness, and they connect with the homeless through their digital media, and they wouldn't know them otherwise. Lydia's Dinner Church in Brooklyn does a robust kind of agape meal, a Sunday meal service that's grown tremendously in their community, and they connect through the week through digital media.
So you're saying that the digital services can help connect people and bring them together and organize
literally
things.
The communion happens at the intersection of what people used to call the virtual and the real, and we're now calling the digitally integrated.
I want to get back to the phones. Anthony is on the line from Fredericksburg. I don't want to run out of time for you. Anthony, what would you like to talk about?
Yes, I am agnostic, and unfortunately I was also confirmed Catholic. I love this topic. It's also a very great and poignant concept that needs to be addressed. I love the fact that they're approaching open ideas in new medias, because you can only grow by learning. And the only thing I'd have to say is that unfortunately, it's like Facebook and Twitter are also invented to make society better. However, there's kind of a double-edged sword that you're walking there. There could be a lot of great things to come from it, but at the same time, there's going to be a lot of negative things that will also arise. Thank you for letting me comment.
Okay, wait, Anthony, before I let you go. So you're talking about generally the negatives that might come with social networks in general,
the possibility of, people that, kind of have similar fears or similar hatreds will meet here just like they meet anywhere else. Unfortunately, they'll be kind of guising it under Jesus and God and the love and the respect that they tried to teach.
Okay. Anthony, thanks a lot for sharing your concerns.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth, do you have a response to that?
Well, I mean, it is absolutely true that as in any other part of human life, there are upsides and there are downsides. So we do see, a couple years ago when I was first talking about prayer on Twitter, it was usually individuals asking for prayer and responding to prayer requests. Now, if you go into Twitter and put in that prayer hashtag, you get a lot of institutional proselytizing. And that creates a space where there's often a lot of arguing. And you know, one of the challenges that I've had for ministry leaders across religious traditions is how do you do ministry in those spaces so that you're helping people to engage religious questions, to think about questions of meaning and value in digital spaces in ways that are civil, are loving, are compassionate. And so there are a number of people in ministry, both lay and ordained now, who really spend time going into Facebook and going into Twitter and helping to mediate conversations so that they're healthier conversations. But it is true that there are things that are going to happen there that are really negative. They're really, you know, name-calling and demeaning, and that's going to be problematic. But that's certainly... you know, it's certainly not the first time in human history that, you know, religious conversations have become ugly. But that is surely going to happen.
Well, Elizabeth Drescher, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Drescher is a religious studies scholar at Santa Clara University in California, author of a number of books, including Tweet If You Heart Jesus, Practicing Church in the Digital Reformation. And Ed Phillips, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Ed Phillips is a professor of worship and liturgical theology at Emory University in Atlanta. He is also a Methodist minister. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to broaden the conversation to talk about other ways that the church is evolving in the 21st century. And my guest will be Phyllis Tickle. She's a leading voice in the emerging church movement. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about religion and how it's evolving in the 21st century. And with me now is Phyllis Tickle. She's an author and lecturer of spirituality and religion in the United States. She's also a contributing editor in religion for Publishers Weekly and helped create the religion department at Publishers Weekly. Her newest book, The Age of the Spirit, How the Ghost of an Ancient Controversy is Shaping the Church, was published in December, and she will be a theologian in residence at the Ames United Church of Christ coming up on February 22nd and 23rd. Hello, Phyllis.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me. I have also enjoyed the program, Massey. I'm a great admirer of Elizabeth Drescher, so it was wonderful to be able to hear her.
Oh, great. A fascinating subject. And before we entirely move on from the digital world, we're going to talk, as I mentioned, more broadly about how the church is changing and evolving. How do you see the digital world changing our religious practices?
Oh, I don't think, I mean, I think Ed's right. To say it's not there would be like saying gravity's not there. It's making a huge difference in all the ways that both of them were talking about. The connectivity and the move toward more communal experience is definitely there. I also thought that your first caller, made an important point. The fact that while one can speak in Reformation terms of the priesthood of all believers and that kind of thing, the internet has allowed that priesthood to be much more reasonable and accessible. Just the sheer quantity of information and intellectual experience about faith, if you will, that's out there as a result of technology. It's overwhelming. Now, there's a certain danger in that also because it's uncontrolled to some extent and unvetted much of it. But nonetheless, the excitement that comes from being able to go look up a passage in the original Greek and even if you don't know Greek, have it transliterated for you right there. That's hugely important and exciting. But I think also, you know, one of the divisions of emergence Christianity that I don't talk about a great deal because it seems ooey-gooey to a lot of people, is cyber church, and it's quite definitely there. And cyber church occurs in virtuality, just as if church occurs in physicality. So you can have a whole religious experience. Barna Research Group has done a good deal of research, as a matter of fact, on just how many of our fellow North Americans have their whole religious experience in cyberspace and attend services. If you go in Second Life, you can certainly go. I'm an Anglican, an Episcopalian. You can certainly go to the Anglican Cathedral of Isle of the Epiphany and have a whole worship service. It's run under the aegis or the Episcopal oversight of the Bishop of Guildford in the UK. but it's absolutely there. The Presbyterians have First Pres SL on Second Life, which obviously is First Presbyterian Church in Second Life. So the online communities are terribly important. I enjoyed Elizabeth's comments, especially about the integration in terms of worship. I know, for instance, the Vineyard in Ann Arbor has been running now for a year or so, a prayer group for its congregants, so that they have exactly what she's talking about, prayer time together every single day, even though they may only see them each other physically on Sunday or maybe twice a week. But they are a worshiping community 24/7 because of the juncture with digital world, with the physical world. I think it's great.
You know, we've talked a great deal about digital and how that is affecting religion, but you believe that this is a time of great change for religion around the world. And for people who aren't familiar with the emerging church, can you explain it for us? What is the emerging church?
Yeah, and let me change the rhetoric just a little bit. Emerging church is one expression of emergence Christianity.
Okay.
We are in a time of enormous upheaval. For some reason, who knows why, every 500 years, Latinized society goes through a giant whoopee or rummage sale or whatever, and it almost always has a technological aspect to it. But 500 years ago, we hit the Great Reformation in the 16th century, and 500 years before that, it was the Great Schism or Great Schism in the 11th century, and the Great Decline and Fall in the 6th century, and the Great Transition, or sometimes called the Great Transformation, of the 1st century, so that there seems to be a sort of pattern. Doesn't mean we have to keep on doing it forever. It just means that if we look at history, we've been here before. When every single thing changes, and we forget sometimes, those of us interested in religion, we forget that religion has a sociological function. It has a sociological duty, and that duty is entirely independent of its theological one, and that is to say to the society in which it exists, what the good is, what's the meaning of the whole experience, who's making the rules, how do we know the good from the bad, the evil from the productive, and that's religion's sociological function, so that when a society changes as completely and dramatically as ours has over the last few decades, then religion, whatever holds pride of place, hegemony, in our case Christianity, has to change and accommodate so that it can talk to and with and for the sake of the society in which it is contextualized. So just as 500 years ago we got Protestants out of a mighty upheaval, this time we're getting emergence Christians, and some of them are emerging church, some of them are emergent church, some of them are cyber church, some of them are neo-monastic, some of them are hyphenated, some of them are small church. There are about 12 divisions within the overarching thing of emergence Christianity, in the same way that there are Baptists and Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians under the overarching idea of Protestantism, so that emergence Christianity has, as I say, some 10, 12 expressions now that are organized, and that to the extent that you can say, there it is, and you can define their differences. But it's all exactly like what happened 500 years ago. And if you look, if you went to secular high school instead of religious high school, you were taught somewhere about the 10th grade, the Reformation. Oh, it was the coming of individualism into the Western experience. It was the beginning of humanism. It was the beginning of the rise of the middle class. It saw the rise of the nation state. It's the institution of capitalism as an economic system. And by the way, it gave us Protestantism. Which is about how you have to look even at this one. This one is the complete change of everything, including the coming of the digital age and a flat earth and an economic system that is no longer pure capitalism, probably hasn't been for quite a while, a middle class that's disappearing. And by the way, it's bringing us a new form of Christianity. It's just that simple.
Well, when you talk about what happened 500 years ago and 500 years before that, in this split with the old church and the new church, there was a great deal of controversy. Do you see? Do you see?
Yes, there was.
Right. But do you see a split like that playing out today, or is this more of an evolutionary process?
Well, you know, they both were evolutionary processes. I think you can't avoid the fact that, and every time we've done it, and you can go back 1,000 years and look at Mediterranean, our conciliary Christianity, splitting into East and West. You know, and you get Eastern Orthodoxy out of that one, and then you get Roman Catholicism at the Western end of things. So every time their upheaval happens, things get shaken up institutionally. There's no question about that. And the truth of it was, there was nothing to make Protestants out of except Roman Catholics. So of course there was great distress. There's nothing to make emergence Christians, whatever their flavor, out of except Roman Catholics and Protestants, and to some extent some Orthodox. So that, yes, but if you look at it historically, you have the Council of Trent, and you have the 30 Years' War, and none of that is very pretty. But you also have changes, major changes, within the Roman Church, all for the better, I think anybody would say, all for the better. And so an accommodation in their structure, even as the Protestant Church emerged and began to develop its own expressions, Presbyterianism, whatever. So this time, and the discussion is usually couched in the rhetoric of inherited or traditional church versus emergence or fresh expressions of church. One would hope we're smarter and brighter now and not going to go to war with each other
right.
over it. But there's no question we're having to learn to accommodate. Yes.
In your opinion, when did this start? What is the period that we're in right now? When was the beginning?
Yes. And that's a fair question. I suspect historians 200-300 years from now will say the Great Emergence will be dated from 9/11. I think that's an unfortunate choice. It certainly isn't mine. But if I hear my colleagues correctly, that's probably what it's going to be called. Now, in the same way that we say the Reformation started on October 31st, 1517, you know and I know that's not true. Luther didn't go to bed a Catholic on the 30th and wake up on the 31st a flaming reformer. There's a lead-in to it, and it usually is about 100, 150 years of lead-in where you can see the established authority being disestablished. So you speak of the Perry Reformation starting about 1390. We can speak of the Perry Emergence and do the Perry Emergence starting in the 1840s, leading up to that moment, which apparently history is going to say was 9/11, when we all looked at each other and said, by jingo, we are into a new way of being. And in our case, we're into a great, what's going to be called the Great Emergence. So there is a lead up to it, and we've been leading up to this thing since about 1840.
All right. So we're in this period right now. It's hard to see that, I suppose, when people are going about their personal devotion and daily practices. Tell me about the future. What do you see coming after this period has passed?
I am not a prophet anyway. I would be hesitant to. I think you can say you can clearly look at all the expressions of emergence Christianity and say certain things. They're not hierarchical in any way. And one of the conflicts is that Protestantism is deeply hierarchical in all of its. That's not true. It's congregational hierarchical, but. The emergence Christianity is deeply narrative. It has very little truck with doctrine per se, not with dogma. Dogma's important, but it really don't give us too much intellectualization of what this or that means. Stick with the narrative and the thrust and the beauty and the mystery. It's deeply aesthetic, far more aesthetic than traditional Protestantism is. And concomitantly with that, it's very liturgical. Jack Spong, Bishop Jack Spong, who has said a number of very brilliant things in his life, said a particularly brilliant one, I think, somewhere back in the 60s. I need to go look up the date sometime, but it's been 40 years at least since Bishop Spong looked and said, to understand what Christians are becoming, what these new Christians are, is to understand that they really are becoming catacomb Christians again. That is, where is the Christianity before Constantine? What did we have back then in those first 3 centuries?
when it was worth dying for, when it was worth being burned at the stake or torn by the animals. Where is that passion? Where is that great truth? Where, when we cut through all the theology and all the accretion of intellectualization, where is the original? So there is an excitement about emergence that I think will carry it. That doesn't answer your question about the future. I don't know exactly. I can make one prediction and have publicly, and we'll make it again. One of the things that's going to happen is, unless I'm crazy, a rapprochement between Judaism and Christianity, to the extent that I suspect many Christians by 2050 or thereabout will be referring to themselves as Judeo-Christian. Mm-hmm. That is, you will hear Emergence Now say, don't tell me it's two stories in one cover. It's one story in one cover, and it's my story. And you hear in almost every setting now, when someone is ready to read, say from the Torah, you will hear the reader in a Christian church say, and the selection from the Hebrew Bible is, as opposed to the fact we used to refer to it as the Old Testament. That kind of subtle change, that awareness that at least the children of Isaac are becoming more and more aware of their commonality than was previously true. So that's going to happen. Definitely the liturgy is more and more important, definitely more communal than it ever has been. So, and there are precedents for this. The church in Jerusalem had to help the church in Antioch, and the church in Antioch had to respect and seek wisdom from the church in Jerusalem. So from our very earliest days, there's an example of intercourse between what has been and what is coming within Christianity. So there's no need to be alarmed. I think we can easily say that. The kingdom of God is in good shape and growing as a result of this.
Phyllis, we have just 1 minute left, and I want to ask you, and you've been a leading voice in the emergent church for some time. You've been incredibly influential with your books, with your writing, with your editing. You are still traveling as of this year. You're going to be, as I mentioned, a theologian in residence at Ames United yes. Church of Christ coming up on February 22nd and 23rd. You're also 80 years old.
Yes, and that's I'm in wind down now. We quit taking contracts the 1st of March of 13. It will take me through January of next year to complete the ones we'd already signed. But yes, I have three books I want to write also, and I can't do that on the road.
All right, so you're not necessarily slowing down in spreading.
Oh no, it's just coming out of public life in order to be able to listen for one thing to somebody besides myself, but also to do these books that I very much want to do.
And what is it that you have left to say?
What is it I have left to say?
Quickly.
I can't say anything quickly. I want to deal with the rapprochement between Judaism and Christianity, because I think it's something we need to be consciously aware of. I want to do a book called Bible Stories That Your Grandmother Never Told You, Volume 1. And it's essentially Christian Midrash, I suspect, tell some of the Hebrew Bible stories as they waffle over and come through and flood into Christianity. Things like Rahab the harlot, for instance, or who was Perez, and who was Nehushtan, and those things that Christian church has not told, or at least not told in terms of how it does waffle in and become a seal,
well,
if you will, or a board between the two.
Phyllis, it sounds like you have a great deal of work left to do. Thank you so much for
talking
with me today.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Phyllis Tickle is an author, a lecturer, an editor. She's a contributing editor in Religion for Publishers Weekly. Her most recent book is The Age of the Spirit, How the Ghost of an Ancient Controversy is Shaping the Church, which was published in December. And Ben Kiefer is here with me now, host of River to River. We talked a little bit about how the middle class is changing religion today. And you're talking about
Yeah, we're going to deal with
class,
a different
right?
perspective on the middle class. Remember, President Obama in his State of the Union address last month said he wanted to strengthen and build ladders of opportunity into the middle class. I'm going to pick up on that cue and talk about where the middle class is being squeezed in the nation right here in Iowa. What is the future of the middle class, and what does that future say about the future of our nation? We're going to be talking with an Iowan who used to be part of the middle class but fell out of the middle class due to medical problems, and she's been searching for a safety net charity.
All right. That's coming up today at noon on River to River. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thanks, Charity.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.